And thanks to James Tennant for that unusual but appropriate introductory music. So, we're back on Unusual Sources, 5 to 6 p.m. every Wednesday. You're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU-FM. Today's special guest is Phil Willeto. Now, Phil is an anti-war activist based in Richmond, Virginia. He's organized the committees against sanctions and war against Iran. He's a member of CASME, that committee. He has organized a tour to Iran and been a part of that tour and written a book about it. He's been involved in many speaking engagements across the United States and also here in Canada. And so we're going to talk a bit about what's going on with him and especially the drive to war with Iran, a very serious issue. So thanks very much for being with us, Phil. Can you hear me coming in on the microphone?
Yes, I can, Brendan. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Well, that's good. I am just saying to our audience that there's always so much going on around you. You're always bound to be involved in something. And last time I spoke with you, you were talking about peace coalition efforts. And now I understand you're going to a large gathering of anti-war activists in the United States. Is that right?
That's right. It's this coming weekend, the 23rd through the 25th, in Albany, New York. It's called the National Unity Anti-War Conference, initiated by the National Assembly to End Wars and Occupations, and is co-sponsored by more than 30 national organizations. And the latest count I heard was somewhere around 500 people have registered, which would make it the largest anti-war conference held in the U.S. in the last 10 years.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that. I mean, reading Counterpunch and some other publications, you get the sense that the anti-war movement in the United States has been somewhat faltering in recent years. But I guess if you're having a very large gathering of activists from different organizations, I guess people are starting to put things back together. Is that the sense you get?
I do, and I think what happened was a lot of folks were so appalled by the administration of George Bush and Dick Cheney, that they felt that any kind of a change would be positive. And then, of course, Barack Obama being the possibility of the first black president of the United States, and also initially being seen as a peace candidate, really got people's hopes up. So a lot of energy went into working to get President Obama elected. Now, a year and a half after he's been in office, there have been a great deal of disappointments, particularly on the issue of war, where it looked like whatever troops are being withdrawn from Iraq are just being resent to Afghanistan. The war has expanded into Pakistan, into Yemen, into Somalia, and the threat of war against Iran. At the same time, the black community, which of course was elated to finally break through this, this glass barrier, this racist barrier against having a person of color elected president, is coming to grips with the fact that the Obama administration has done very little in the way of trying to relieve the unemployment and foreclosure crisis facing the black community. So there's been sort of a sobering and a waking up, and people getting over their initial euphoria and then disappointments. And while we all realize that this has been a tremendous change in terms of race relations in the U.S., it hasn't changed the fundamental policies of the government, and people are starting to become active again on a wide range of issues.
Yes, it's an unfortunate duality you have there. On the one sense, it is a positive change that Obama has come in elected as a black president, and it did raise people's hopes on a number of issues. But on the other hand, so many of the Bush-Cheney policies are still in place. So you still have a war in Afghanistan. In fact, it's being escalated. You have troops in Iraq still. The occupation continues. But Obama did talk about the importance of Afghanistan, and he has indeed delivered on that. So the intensity of the conflict is greater now than it was in the past. The amount of American deaths is higher. The number of battles that are occurring, they're all rising. And the escalation in Pakistan has occurred as well. So, on the one hand, we're glad that Bush is gone and that Sarah Palin didn't get in. But the war agenda, the enormous, unprecedented budget for the military operations abroad have all gotten worse in a sense. And I guess that's one of the things you're going to be talking about at your conference. But it also relates to one of the greatest dangers that we thought had gone on the back burner for a while but now appears to be coming back. And that, of course, is the possibility of military action against Iran. And I know people have been picking up some of the signals that have been coming out lately. And a lot of it is very reminiscent of Iraq, but we can get into that. But there's, First of all, I know there's military movements. I believe a U.S. battle group transited, I guess, off Egypt through the Red Sea, getting into position near Iran. Do you know about those ships?
I mean, there's been a lot of reports recently about ship movements by the U.S. and also including elements of the Israeli Navy about U.S. forces moving up to the area of Azerbaijan and the northeast border of Iran, calls by the leadership of Saudi Arabia for the U.S. to take some kind of action against Iran, and going so far by some officials as hinting that Saudi Arabia could accept a military attack on Iran. Some of this is can be verified. Some of this that has been looked into has turned out to be false rumors. It certainly would be the policy of some in the U.S. administration to try to convince Iran that that the possibility of military action is very real, thinking that that's going to force them to capitulate to the demands on the nuclear issue. It's difficult to tell, but there is a growing of cacophony of voices arguing that that sanctions will not work in forcing Iran to meet U.S. demands, and that the alternative of a containment policy, in other words, Iran could get a nuclear bomb, and then the forces could contain it as the U.S. Tried to do with the Soviet Union, would also not be successful, and that therefore military action is the only way to deal with the situation. I think while we're talking about this in terms of recent current events, it's important just to drop back for a second and deal with the central charge against Iran, which is that its program to develop nuclear power for peaceful energy purposes is actually a cover for it to develop nuclear weapons. And because that is the position of the United States and its allies in the United Nations Security Council and Israel, the United States recognizes that Iran has the right to develop nuclear power. It has that right under international law, specifically as a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that has been signed by all but a handful of countries in the world.
Well, this is really important, actually.
And that part of that, pursuing that peaceful energy is enriching uranium. The United States recognizes Iran's right to develop nuclear power, but demands that it stop enriching uranium, because it claims that that Iran will pursue that process to the point where it could develop a nuclear weapon. That's the crux of the disagreement. So if Iran were to capitulate to U.S. demands, it's essentially giving up its sovereign right to develop nuclear power, which it needs to diversify its energy sources, and would also be giving up its rights as a sovereign country. It's not going to do that. The United States knows this, so it's making an impossible demand, which is actually leading to a confrontational situation that could actually result in a war. It's a false charge, similar to what the U.S. Leveled against Iraq about having weapons of mass destruction. There is no shred of proof by any country in the world or by the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is a nuclear watchdog enforcing the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, no evidence whatsoever that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, and yet that is what it is accused of doing. There's no way it can prove it isn't, and that's why we had the standoff.
Well, I mean, this nuclear issue itself is just part of a deeper issue, and that is that, as you said, even the United States knows that Iran cannot give in to the nuclear demands because it would have to give up its own rights to make decisions as a country. But they're pushing on that issue nonetheless, because the real problem is with Iran itself, the fact that they can't control Iran, that they can't tell Iran what to do or how to manage its affairs. So if it wasn't the nuclear issue, they'd find some other issue to hammer them on that they wouldn't be able to yield on. But the nuclear issues is what's become the crux, of course. And you can read all sorts of reports, and when you actually look at what's being said by the IAEA or anyone else, there's no evidence that it's a nuclear weapons program, right? So if you read the articles about Brazil and Turkey making peaceful agreements with Iran, you'll learn that there's no evidence certified by the IAEA again this spring that the Iranian nuclear material has been diverted to a weapons program. There's no evidence that Iran is attempting to enrich uranium at 95% as part of a nuclear weapons program. So they've been through this over and over again. The IAEA, they've said over and over again that there's no evidence that there is a nuclear program now. There wasn't one last year, and so on and so on. But they keep pushing on this issue. And they do have the right to peacefully enrich the uranium.
Yes, under the NPT, they do.
And interestingly enough, as has been commented before, I mean, Iran's neighbors or countries in the region, whether it be Pakistan, India, Israel, all have nuclear weapons programs. Many of those are outside of the boundaries of the NPT and therefore would be considered illegal. But it's Iran who gets punished despite sticking...
Well, no, it would not be considered illegal. Israel, Pakistan, and India all have nuclear weapons and none have signed the NPT. And because they haven't signed the NPT, their pursuit of nuclear weapons was not illegal. I mean, they didn't violate anything. So they're free. They're scot-free. In terms of the NPT and its enforcement by the IAEA. Now, India, which hasn't signed on to the NPT, is actually a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency charged with investigating whether Iran has violated the NPT. I mean, that's how crazy it's gotten. And, of course, Israel, which actually is the only country in the Middle East with nuclear weapons, more than 200 of them, by the best estimates, is just threatening, openly to attack Iran if the sanctions don't force Iran to abandon its pursuit of nuclear power. So the whole thing is so phenomenally hypocritical, not to mention the fact that, you know, Iran is projected as the potential aggressor in this situation. But if you look at the map, to the west of Iran, the U.S. has invaded Iraq, overthrown the government, slammed down an occupation. You know, hundreds of thousands, if not a million, Iraqis have died. If you look over in the east, the U.S. has invaded Afghanistan, overthrown the government, occupied the country, and is killing civilians as well as insurgents. Below Afghanistan is Pakistan, which is a country that does harbor terrorists and has nuclear weapons, and also harbors not only the Taliban figures that are active in Afghanistan, but harbors members of organizations like the Jundala, an extremist group in southwest Pakistan, across the border into Iran, and commit terrorist acts. So it's Iran that actually feels, under attack, under military threat, under physical threat, and yet it's being accused of being the aggressor. At the same time, while there's no evidence that Iran's developing nuclear weapons, the supreme leader of the country, Ali Khamenei, has issued a fatwa years ago and reiterated just recently this April at a conference on nuclear weapons proliferation that was held in Tehran, that it would be against Islam for Iran to develop nuclear weapons because they're weapons of mass destruction that kill civilians, and that's against their view of Islam. So, you know, they're being accused of being religious fanatics, but when you look at what they say as religious leaders, that they denounce nuclear weapons, there's no evidence that they have them. What they do have is the third largest oil reserve in the Middle East, and a foreign policy that is anti-imperialist and opposed to U.S. domination of the area. And that's why they're being targeted.
Well, you know, as you've been pointing out, the United States is sort of seesawing between sanctions and military options. And just the other day, President Obama reaffirmed that United States and Israel maintain a close coordination of actions and interests regarding Iran. That's what he said. And he also said, "We try to coordinate on issues of mutual concern, and that approach is one that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel is committed to." And you know, he said that the White House will not accept the possession of nuclear weapons by Iran, and that the administration will do everything they can to prevent that from happening. "So we will continue to keep the door open for a diplomatic resolution of this challenge," said Obama. "I assure you, I have not taken options off the table. All options are on the table." Remember the last time someone said that? I believe that was in the lead-up to the war against Iraq.
Yeah, I think the Obama administration is in a very difficult situation right now. it had a schedule, timetable for withdrawing from Iraq, and they're approaching that, but there's a very unstable political situation. At the same time, they have some 15 permanent military bases and the largest U.S. embassy in the world. So they never really, in Baghdad, so they never really were planning on completely withdrawing. But they wanted to get out of a combat role, and now there's a question of whether they can do that. In Afghanistan, they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. So it's Vietnam all over again. There's a popular insurgency. There's a very unpopular, corrupt government that the U.S. is supporting. They can't win the minds and hearts of the people because they're supporting an unpopular government and because they're killing civilians. And it's unlikely that they are going to, you know, with 100,000, 150,000, or 200,000 troops, subdue the insurgency. So it's already a nine-year war, and there's no end in sight, and they don't know what to do. Here they're faced with another situation with Iran, which they've thrown down the gauntlet and said, you end your nuclear enrichment program, or we're going to squeeze you to death with sanctions, or if that doesn't work, we're going to bomb the hell out of you. Well, what does that mean? If they attack Iran, they can't occupy it. They can bomb it, but they can't occupy it. It's a country of 70 million people. It's four times the population of Iraq. They can't move. They have no troops to move into Iran. So what are they going to do? They're going to bomb it and then sit back and wait for Iran to retaliate, which it can on so many different levels. It can sink ships in the Gulf of Hormuz and block one-third of the world's oil shipping. You know, it can appeal to its allies with Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. It has the sympathy of rank-and-file Muslims and others across the region, and as well as the support of countries like Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia that are attempting to pursue an anti-imperialist agenda in Latin America. Iran is not isolated. It's the United States that's isolated when it comes to this particular issue. It's the United States and Israel and a handful of Western nuclear powers versus the majority of the world. And for example, in May, the 114 countries that belong to the non-aligned movement issued a statement to the IAEA supporting Iran's right to develop energy for peaceful nuclear purposes. That statement was issued the day before the United Nations Security Council, made up of 15 members, imposed the fourth round of sanctions. Brazil and Turkey voted against those sanctions, and Lebanon abstained. But the other 12 countries, imposed these sanctions. So it's 12 countries imposing the sanctions, and the majority of countries in the world, saying that Iran had the right to develop nuclear power. So the U.S. is in a tough spot here. It's already bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's fighting a soldierless war through drones in Pakistan. Taking on Yemen, it's bombing villages that it claims are harboring al-Qaeda elements in Somalia, and it's going to take on a war against 7 million people with a modern military. I think they're in a big, big jam, and they also look at Israel, which is, a pit bull for the Western powers in the Middle East. It's a vicious little dog, but it's on a strong leash, and sometimes it remembers that it has a master, and sometimes it forgets. I think right now, Netanyahu in charge being pushed by the right wing in his coalition government, it's beginning to think that maybe it should act on its own. And the United States master has to pull that string back and say, listen, we'll tell you when to attack and when not to attack. And Netanyahu is mumbling under his breath about it, but so far he's following orders. It's a very, very volatile situation. The kind of a thing where with the U.S. military buildup in the Persian Gulf and in the region, an incident could happen, such as the U.S. downing the civilian Airbus in 1988, killing 290 men, women, and children in something they called an unfortunate accident. Something could happen that could set off a spark that could lead us into, a vastly more dangerous world situation than we're under now. So, we don't have to stand by and be bystanders of history. We don't have to just observe it and talk about it and write about it. And, we're not chronicling the sinking of the Titanic here. We need to get out and take on this issue and and demand that there be no war sanctions against Iran and get the U.S. the hell out of the Middle East, U.S. and its allies, including Canada.
Yes, no, and I understand that Israel has been making a lot of noise in regard to an attack. Their newspapers have talked about modifying jets for long-range attacks and so on and so forth. And as a result of the danger of a war situation and the problems inherent in that, that the sanctions are a preferred option for the United States right now. I think this time, the new round of sanctions, they're looking to deny refined gasoline into Iran so that even though Iran produces oil, they won't be able to import the finished product and there'll be gasoline shortages and whatnot. I've heard they're going to be trying to prevent Iranian aircraft from refueling at foreign airports in Europe or elsewhere. I mean, you're talking about numerous effects on civilian industry in Iran, and even though the United States says that they don't think the sanctions will negatively impact Iranian people, I've seen U.S. newspaper interviews talking about how people think they might be affected by a fuel shortage or higher fuel prices or higher food prices and so on. So, because they're going to lose technical assistance and technology transfers in these sanctions too. So, these appear to be quite dangerous, but this is just the United States and a few countries pushing for this, right? Because you talked about the rest of the international community, more than 140 countries that would not like to see sanctions, and there was that deal with Brazil and Turkey. What had they been trying to arrange?
Well, last year, under pressure from the United States, France and Russia made a proposal to Iran that it ship its low-enriched uranium out of the country and then receive back in exchange higher enriched uranium that could fuel a nuclear reactor in Tehran that makes medical isotopes for cancer patients. Just a very, very, very quick technical lesson here. Uranium is a natural substance. It has to be purified, enriched, in order to be useful as fuel. If it's enriched to a point up to 5%, it's useful in nuclear power plants. If it's enriched up to a point of close to 20%, it's useful in medical reactors that create these isotopes. It has to be enriched to a point of about 95% in order to be used in nuclear weapons. And each stage of the further enrichment involves different processes, larger programs. And it's not simply a question of, turning a dial from low to high. So if Iran were involved in attempting to enrich uranium to the highest levels, it would be virtually impossible for it to hide from the very intrusive inspections that the IAEA carry out. But Russia and France said, well, let's alleviate all doubts here. Let's ship 1,200 kilograms, which at the time was about 70% of its low-enriched uranium, the 5%, to Russia. France will then supply Iran with the fuel rods to be used in the Tehran research reactor. And they would get those rods back within a year. And Iran said, well, okay, we accept this deal on principle. Because after all, they're not trying to build nuclear weapons in the first place, they say, and I think that's correct. However, what guarantee do we have if we turn over the majority of our low-enriched uranium that you're ever going to give it back to us? I mean, after all, it's not the first time you've reneged on a treaty agreement. What recourse would we have? We have none. So let's talk about how we can refine this proposal. Instead, the Obama administration said, no, take it or leave it, our way or the highway, and walked away from negotiations. So Brazil and Turkey, who are two countries that are playing, see themselves as playing an increasingly important role on the world scene and are temporary members of the UN Security Council, there's five permanent members and then there's 10 rotating members, they approached Iran and said, well, look, maybe we can come up with another solution. How about if you transfer your low-enriched uranium to Turkey, and that if you don't get the rods back, the fuel rods back, with the higher enriched uranium within a year, you can ask to get your low enriched uranium back and we'll give it to you. Well, NATO is a NATO country. Turkey is a NATO country, but it's also a Muslim country, has better relationships with Iran. Brazil has, a foreign policy that's, distinctly different from the United States, although it's not, as far to the left as Venezuela, say. But Iran said, well, you know, that sounds good. You know, I think we could go with that. And so the presidents of Iran and Brazil and the prime minister of Turkey announced in Tehran an agreement, the Tehran agreement, to go along with this new proposal. Immediately, within 24 hours, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton denounced the agreement as a sham and said that the U.S. would be immediately pressing for new sanctions from the U.N. Security Council, fourth round of sanctions. And then the U.S. Congress passed a new set of U.S. sanctions, and Obama signed them. And the message was clear. We're going to make a proposal. If you agree to it, we'll denounce the proposal. You know, if you agree to a modified version of the proposal, we'll just move the goalposts. We're not interested in coming into an agreement with you. We're just interested in forcing you into a situation where you cannot agree to demands, and then we can declare you an international outlaw and deal with you as such. And what's interesting is that this follows so closely the prognosis and proposals outlined in a book by a fellow named Dennis Ross, who is the Obama administration point person on Iran. The guy's a neocon. He's been a supporter of Israel his whole political career. He used to be at the State Department under Hillary Clinton for Iran, and he was moved over to the White House as the National Security Council and Obama's specific point person on Iran. He has been a Middle East expert working in every U.S. administration going back to Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s, Reagan, Clinton, both Bushes, and now Obama. What it showed, and what he said in his book was, look, if we look like we're seriously negotiating with Iran, and then the negotiations don't work, that will make it much easier to get international approval for stronger measures, including sanctions and possibly military action. Go through the motions of negotiating, and then you get international support. This is the guy who has Obama's ear on Iran policy. So it's not about nuclear weapons. It's not about uranium enrichment. It's not about, you know, threats to Israel or threats to world peace or, you know, a leadership in Iran that can't be dealt with rationally. All of that is so much BS. What it's about is that there is a strong, independent, oil-rich country in the Middle East that doesn't like U.S. policy, that doesn't like Israeli policy, is defying U.S. imperialism and has to be crushed. And if we allow that to happen, it doesn't matter what people think of the internal situation in Iran, what they think of the Iranian government. What matters is it possible for countries to pursue their own destinies in the world free from the dictates of the United States and its Western allies? Or are we living in a Pax Americana, a new Roman Empire in which everybody has to bow to the emperor, which is not Obama, but it's the oil companies and the banks and the U.S. corporations that really run this world? That's what's at stake here. So, again, I know you're based in Hamilton there. It's not that far to come to Albany, New York. People could get on the Internet and look up www.nationalpeaceconference.org and get all the information, nationalpeaceconference.org, and drop down, and your folks from Canada would be more than welcome, find out what's going on down here, and maybe there'd be an opportunity to coordinate some activities in Canada. It's not just Iran. It's, the Western, overthrow of President Aristide in Haiti and the occupation of that country. It's threats to undermine the progressive governments of Venezuela and Ecuador and Bolivia and Cuba. You know, it's threats to, there's a new South Korean U.S. military maneuvers that's just about to take place, you know, to counter North Korean aggression, is the way it was described in today's daily newspaper. But obviously, it's preparation for the possibility of war. And we gotta unite across national boundaries and start standing up for ourselves as working people, as progressive people, as people who don't have an interest in any one country dominating the world. And we need a new international solidarity based on respect for the right of self-determination of oppressed peoples. And for that reason, I just really want to thank you for this opportunity you know, to speak to your, you know, your listenership and to really encourage us to develop stronger cross-border ties between anti-war activists and progressives in Canada and the United States.
Well, thank you, Phil. And, you know, I can't wait to hear what comes out of this conference. And it's good to see things moving in the United States again on the anti-war movement. And, yeah, we're gonna see more actions, I think, in the future. So, Phil, thanks for taking your time and being on our program. We really appreciate the insight you've been able to give us. Again, Phil, thanks for being available for us today.
Could I do just one last thing?
Of course.
Just encourage people to go to the Defenders website. It's the organization we have here in Richmond. You can just Google Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality or the Virginia Defender newspaper, and you'll come up and find out what some things we don't hear locally. We don't just work on anti-war issues. We're very dug into the community, and we try to unite those kind of issues. So thanks again, and we'll be in touch and hope to see you sometime in Hamilton again.
Well, thanks very much, Phil. You take care.